Issues are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, we invite you to go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, coming up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Vladimir Putin visits China, American protectionism, Biden's tariffs on Chinese exports, and the U.S. makes an unusual request of China and Russia. First, Putin visits China. Xi Jinping's balancing act with Russia and the West took on a new challenge with Putin's arrival in Beijing. It was roughly the 40th such meeting of these supposedly old friends. Once again, Xi had to demonstrate loyalty to Russia in its war in Ukraine, while also showing sensitivity to European commercial interests and U.S. pressure on China to limit its military support of Putin's war. At least on the surface, Xi came through. He promised to expand all manner of China-Russia ties, fully support their, quote, comprehensive strategic partnership, increase strategic coordination, support Russia's special military operation, not war, in Ukraine, and condemn U.S. dual containment of China and Russia. Their joint statement gave no indication of differences on either global strategy or specific issues, though this time there was no mention, as there had been when Putin visited in February 2022, of no limits to the partnership. In any case, too much attention has been paid to no limits, and not enough to the upper hand Xi has with Putin. In a word, Russia needs China far more than the reverse. The Chinese determine how much and what kind of assistance to provide to Russia, whether as a customer or an exporter. So far, China has stepped up, though not to the extent of challenging U.S. and European sanctions. One specialist underscores Russian dependence on China by saying, quote, China has emerged as Russia's single most important partner, providing a lifeline not only for Mr. Putin's war machine, but also for the entire embattled economy. In 2023, Russia's trade with China hit a record $240 billion, up by more than 60% from pre-war levels, as China accounted for 30% of Russia's exports and nearly 40% of its imports. Before the war, Russia's trade with the European Union was double that with China. Now it's less than half. As for military aid to Russia, China is again the key provider. As the New York Times reports, quote, last year some 89% of the high priority imports necessary for Russian weapons production came from China, according to a customs data analysis by Nathaniel Scheer, a researcher at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Those included everything from machine tools used to build military equipment to optical devices, electronic sensors, and telecommunications gear, the analysis found, unquote. U.S. and European Union efforts to get Beijing to cut back on dual-use items that support Russia's military industry have gone nowhere. Xi may also have the upper hand with the European Union, for despite German and especially French efforts to get Xi to agree to do more to persuade Putin to end his war, Xi has been able to use the EU's dependence on Chinese trade and investment to nod yes on peace and do nothing to promote it. China's line on the war has not changed since the start. Calls for a peace settlement, defense of the principle of respect for territorial integrity, a nod to Ukraine, support of a country's legitimate security interests, a nod to Russia, and willingness to take part in peace talks. These are evasions, not interventions, as China's leadership clearly believes the Ukraine war has more benefits than costs. Next, American protectionism, Biden's tariffs on Chinese exports. The Biden administration shares European concerns about China's flooding of the market in electric vehicles, solar panels, steel, and a host of other goods, which, thanks to state subsidies, are underpricing the same U.S.-produced items. The administration is planning to raise tariffs to protect home industries, quadrupling electric vehicle tariffs to 100%, tripling certain levies on steel and aluminum products to 25% and doubling the rate on semiconductors to 50%. As the New York Times reports, quote, Chinese exports could soon pose a threat to some of the American companies that Mr. Biden has tried to bolster with federal grants and tax incentives, much of which comes from his 2022 climate law. Biden says the Chinese are not competing, they're cheating, overproducing at home and selling this overcapacity abroad, as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen charged when she visited Beijing last month. Biden may claim his tariff increases are different from Trump's because they aim to protect specific high-tech industries. The Chinese fail to see the difference. They respond that they're the victims here. As a foreign ministry spokesman said, quote, the real purpose is to hold back China's high-quality development and deprive China of its legitimate right to development. There isn't a Chinese overcapacity, he said, but a U.S. overcapacity of anxiety stemming from lack of confidence and smears against China. Rumors are circulating that China may respond to high U.S. tariffs, not just by raising their own, as they did when Trump raised U.S. tariffs, but by devaluing China's currency. That would mean cheaper Chinese exports, which, given U.S. consumers' insatiable demand for Chinese goods, would have a major negative impact on the U.S. trade picture. Is another trade war looming with China? The United States makes an unusual request of China and Russia. The Biden administration has requested that China and Russia not allow artificial intelligence, AI, to take the place of humans when making decisions about nuclear weapons. Quote, we certainly have made a very clear and strong commitment that in cases of nuclear employment, that decision would only be made by a human being. We would never defer a decision on nuclear employment to AI. We strongly stand by that statement, and we've made it publicly with our colleagues in the United Kingdom and France. We would welcome a similar statement by China and the Russian Federation. Paul Dean, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of Arms Control, Deterrence and Stability, made that request public in a briefing on May 2. Let us hope that we and the other nuclear weapon states never again get to the point of deploying a nuclear weapon in an ongoing conflict, much less relying on AI to do so. But then, why is the U.S. Air Force planning to rely on AI in fighter jets? According to a report by Public Citizen, quote, the U.S. Air Force is testing F-16 fighter jets controlled by artificial intelligence, even conducting training dogfights in American airspace between aircraft piloted by AI and those with human crews. The Air Force says it will deploy armed, automated, uncrewed fighter jets in as little as 6 years, unquote. So, it's okay to use AI on jets that are armed with air-to-surface missiles? And when AI on cars still don't function properly? In other news, Putin's surprise appointment as defense secretary. Vladimir Putin decided to force out one of his generals, Sergei Shoigu, as defense secretary and appoint Andrei Belousov, an advisor on the economy for the past 6 years. What to make of the appointment? Quote, Putin's priority is war, and war of attrition is won by economics, said Alexandra Prokopenko, a former Russian central bank official now at the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin. Belousov, fittingly for a war of attrition, referred to improving conditions for Russia's soldiers in his first public statement. Russia has paid dearly in lives for its aggression, and now it is clearly prepared to fight for years to come. The economics of warfare thus have high priority: veterans affairs, bureaucratic coordination, military procurement, and the budget. This appointment may also relate to Putin's so-called peace plans. According to a number of Russians close to Kremlin thinking, Putin's idea is to settle the war by keeping all the territory his forces currently occupy. He is said to want to avoid a forever war, but is prepared to go on fighting if he can't get what he wants. Ukraine, of course, is adamantly opposed to surrendering any territory. Thus, the war of attrition has no foreseeable end. German environmentalists attack a Tesla plant. Several hundred German environmental activists who oppose Tesla production battled with police in a factory outside Berlin. The activists had tried to storm the factory. Environmental groups have been engaged against Tesla since the factory opened in 2022. The town in which the factory is located voted against having the plant there, but the vote wasn't legally binding. Now, Tesla is seeking to expand the plant into a nearby forest. The local police only detained one protester, baffling Elon Musk, who said, quote, "Why do the police let the left-wing protesters off so easily?" An Israeli detention camp for Palestinians is uncovered. Three Israeli whistleblowers who worked inside a detention camp in the Negev desert have told of the appalling conditions for Palestinian prisoners. The camp might be called Israel's Guantanamo. One of them took photos that show, quote, rows of men in gray tracksuits seen sitting on paper-thin mattresses ring-fenced by barbed wire. All appear blindfolded, their heads hanging heavy under the glare of floodlights. A putrid stench filled the air and the room hummed with the men's murmurs. Forbidden from speaking to each other, the detainees mumbled to themselves, unquote. The camp, called Sedeh Taiman, is located in an Israeli military base about 18 miles inside the Gaza-Egypt border. According to the whistleblower accounts provided to CNN, quote, the facility is split into two parts, enclosures where around 70 Palestinian detainees from Gaza are placed under extreme physical restraint, and a field hospital where wounded detainees are strapped to their beds wearing diapers and fed through straws, unquote. The Israeli Defense Forces response, quote, the IDF ensures proper conduct toward the detainees in custody. Any allegation of misconduct by IDF soldiers is examined and dealt with accordingly. In appropriate cases, the Military Police Criminal Division investigations are opened when there is suspicion of misconduct justifying such action, unquote. Anger at Israel and the U.S. is spreading into Jordan. Most of the attention in the Gaza war these days is being paid to the Israeli attack on Rafah. But here's a less publicized response to the war. In an article for The New Yorker, Rania Abu Zaid, based in Amman, Jordan, writes about angry protesters who have been demonstrating for many days against their government. Though Jordanian leaders have sharply criticized Israel's assault on Gaza, it maintains diplomatic and trade relations with Israel, hosts U.S. troops, and receives more USA than any Middle Eastern country except Israel. The demonstrators would torch the Israeli embassy if not blocked by Jordanian security forces. Her article indicates that this seething anger reflects public opinion throughout the Middle East. Quote, in January, the Doha Institute's Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies released the findings of what it called the first survey to gauge public opinion about the Gaza conflict across the Arab world. 92% of respondents said that the Palestinian cause was not solely the concern of Palestinians, but of all Arabs, the highest proportion since polling began more than a decade ago. More than 75% considered the U.S. and Israel, quote, the biggest threat to the security and stability of the region, unquote. Two-thirds described the Hamas attack as a legitimate resistance operation. These views, to repeat, represent public opinion, not the opinion of Arab governments. As in Jordan, Arab publics are sharply critical of their governments for their often half-hearted support of the Palestinian cause. Finally, mass protests in Georgia, the country. Georgia, which lives under the shadow of Russia, faces a potential crisis. Tens of thousands of people protested in Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, against a draft law designed, just like one in Russia, to crack down on so-called foreign agents. The law is seen by critics and rights groups as a threat to democracy in the South Caucasus nation. The law, now passed by parliament, requires non-governmental groups and independent media outlets to register as agents of foreign influence. It would apply to organizations, activist groups, and media outlets that receive more than 20% of their funding from abroad. The clear target is U.S. and European non-governmental organizations that support democratic practices and human rights. The majority party in parliament, called Georgian Dream, supports the law, saying it will keep foreign interference out of Georgia's politics. But the real purpose may be the opposite, as the country's president, who is not a member of that party, says, namely, to promote Russia's interference in Georgia and frustrate Georgia's efforts to enter the European Union. The president has vetoed the bill, saying it is, quote, Russian in its essence, but Georgian Dream has overridden the veto. The larger issue here is the potential for Russian intervention if popular opposition to the draft law threatens the Georgian Dream that has strong Russian support. We need only recall that Russia already occupies 20% of Georgia's territory, and that Russia has a history of interventions in its near abroad, in Belarus, Kazakhstan, and of course Ukraine. And in Georgia, there is substantial support for Ukraine, including by young Georgians who have gone there to fight the Russian invasion. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to Cable News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. In November, Portlanders will have a new election method before them to help decide the composition of the new city council. It's ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting was part of a suite of changes in the charter reform that was passed in 2022. Ranked choice voting represents a pretty big shift from how voters are filling out their ballots normally, so we're here to learn some more about it. I spoke with Grace Ramsey with Democracy Rising. She's a national expert in ranked choice voting, and we're going to go more into what RCV is all about. Welcome to the show, Grace.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here.
I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Let's start with a little bit of primer here, since, you know, this is a new issue for a lot of our listeners. What is ranked choice voting?
Yeah, so ranked choice voting, it's kind of in the name. So voters rank their choices, right? But let's think of how kind of a typical election that we think of works. You look at the list of candidates, you either pick your favorite or pick the one that you like but has the best chance of winning. You fill in that bubble, that's it, right? And you just really hope that they do well. With ranked choice voting, it's a little bit more involved than that, right? We get to ask voters their preferences in a more profound way, or a more nuanced way, I guess. And so instead of just picking that one candidate and hoping they do well, voters get to rank their choices. You get to pick that favorite candidate that you have, but you also get to think, okay, so if that candidate doesn't have enough support to be in the running, who's my backup choice, right? So you have those choices that you can rank for those candidates.
Well, I know that you have helped implement ranked choice voting in different cities and states around the country. How do those different systems differ from each other? As in, how many are you allowed to rank? Or how does that kind of thing shake out?
You know, you don't want to necessarily say every city is a snowflake, but they kind of are. Every state, every city has different ways of doing things. So it's varied a lot from different places. The nice thing is, for voters, the process is essentially the same. You pick your favorite candidate, mark them as your first choice, pick your next favorite candidate, mark them as your second choice, and so on. But let's see. So I got my start in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where they use ranked choice voting, but they only use it for one person at a time. So that's a slight difference, right? So here, the way Portlanders are going to use ranked choice voting to elect mayor and auditor, that would be across the board in Minneapolis. Whereas here, you all are electing three council members from each of the four geographic districts. So I'm biased in both directions, right? Of Minneapolis is where I learned about this and really feels like kind of where I became aware of that we could do democracy differently. Whereas I think the system that Portland is implementing is really cool, and I'm really excited about it.
So, right, you rank your choices, mm-hmm. and it's exciting because it's more expansive than two, or sort of, you know, bargaining with who is most likely to win that most matches me, right? What happens to those votes after they're cast?
Sure. So it works a little differently depending on which elections we're talking about. So let's start by just talking about if we are electing mayor or auditor, where we only have one person. So the way that you win in a ranked choice voting election when you're just electing one person is you need to earn more than half of the votes, because only one person can do that, right? If two people have more than half, something has gone wrong. And so what we do is we start by only looking at voters' first choices. Those backup choices on your ballot, we're not looking at them at all. And if somebody has more than half of the votes, they win. We're done. But the part about ranked choice voting that's very cool, and let's also think about that in like larger election contexts, right? There are a ton of elections that we have where when we look at voters' choices, nobody has more than half of the votes, right? And so whoever has the most wins, and then we're done. And that could mean a lot of people aren't represented in that election or in who's going to be in office. So with ranked choice voting, we take it a step further. If no one has more than half of the votes, we eliminate the candidate with the least amount of support. And so that candidate, you know, probably gave it a great effort, but for one reason or another, just wasn't really pulling a lot of support from the community. We eliminate that candidate, and the voters who ranked that candidate as that first choice would have their vote instantly go to their next choice. And then we repeat where we look and see if anybody has more than half of the votes. If not, we eliminate the next candidate with the fewest votes, and the same process happens, and we keep going until we have someone win with more than half of the votes, until somebody passes that sort of finish line. And that way we build consensus within the electorate. And for city council, it works the exact same way for voters, but a little bit differently in terms of how the votes are counted. So just like we said, only one person can get more than half of the votes when we're just electing one person, like mayor or auditor. If we're electing more than one person, the number of votes somebody needs to win changes. So for instance, with Portland, each district will be electing 3 members of the city council. And so the question becomes, how many votes can 3 candidates all get that 4 can't? And that number is 25%, a quarter of the votes. Because if 4 people have more than a quarter of the vote, something has gone wrong, right? We have too many votes accounted for. So 25%, or just over 25%, is the number of votes people need to win. And so we start the exact same way. Voters rank those candidates in order of choice, and we only look at first choices when we start. If 3 candidates have more than 25% of the vote, we're done. Everybody's elected. If they don't, then we go into that process again, right? And the slight difference with the city council races that I think is really, it's just where this gets so cool, in my opinion, as an elections nerd a little bit, but also as somebody who wishes I had something like this where I live. So if a candidate has a ton of votes, more than they need to be elected, we don't want to punish a lot of voters for feeling the same way. If you're electing 3 seats and there's a huge group of you that feel really similar about a candidate's platform or the issues that are running this election, if there's a huge, huge group of you, we don't want to limit you to one of those seats. If maybe your strength in the electorate probably entitles you to more than one of those seats, right? And so what happens is if a candidate gets way more votes than they need, each of those voters would have a small portion, a tiny little portion, each of those voters go to their next choice on the ballot. So that is why this is a proportional system. That's why you've heard that, is that voters are getting their share of representation in proportion to their strength in the electorate. So if a candidate overperforms, again, each of those voters gets a little bit of their vote to go to their next choice. The way I think about it is my vote is a dollar. And let's say a candidate is so popular, they only needed 90 cents of my dollar to get elected. And so in a ranked choice system like this, I get to spend my 10 cents that's left over on another candidate. It's not my whole vote, but it's a little bit of my vote because that candidate just didn't need all of it. So we do that. And then we check, you know, do we have all of our seats filled? And if not, we repeat that process of eliminating the candidate with the fewest votes. Those voters instantly have their vote go to their next choice. And then we keep that process going until we have our 3 seats.
Thank you for explaining that. I've heard some criticism or maybe confusion recently about how it becomes proportional, right? Mm-hmm. And concerns that, you know, only 25% of a district is able to put a person on city council.
I would challenge to think of that from the other perspective. 75% of voters in those districts will have a say in who represents them, right? If 3 candidates are getting 25% of the vote, 75% of voters get a say. And so it is different, right? Having that level be different. But also, let's think about other races that we've seen in our normal elections where there's tons of candidates and somebody can win with 14%, right? So every election has its things, right? Like our status quo, you may not be surprised, I don't always love in a lot of situations because I don't think it always supports the breadth of choice that voters are looking for. And so this system answers for that and makes sure that we're representing people in proportion to their strength in the electorate.
I'm interested in your perspective on, you know, this being adopted in other places. Have you noticed common themes about how it's received?
Yeah. I think you said before that there are concerns, and I want to stress that, like, change is difficult, and people being concerned for their community is a good thing. Right? Like, people saying, like, hey, I want to make sure that we do this right, and I want to make sure that people get this. I think that's great. And for people who feel that way, I am hoping that they engage in voter education in this cycle. I hope they talk with folks and their neighbors and make sure that they're ready to go. I think change, is difficult on every level whenever you change something, right? If there's a big new program being rolled out at the city level, if there's new services available to folks, there's always work that needs to be done to make that happen. And so what I've found is across the country, people are really invested in that work, however it gets done. And so that's what I do. And I've always been really excited to do so. And it's really fulfilling. But I think that's what we sense is there's some people who are really excited for something new. And then there are some people who are saying, okay, cool, you said all of these things are great. Let's see how this goes. And that's where I love when we have, you know, voter education efforts in these places, because we get to take those folks, say, what are your concerns? We want to hear you out. We want to make sure that we are aware of what's going on, but also, like, join us. Let's go talk to people about it. Let's go make sure that we're getting ahead of anything that's concerning folks. And I think over the years, you know, I've been educating voters about ranked choice voting specifically for 10 years now. I can understand how for some folks nationally, there's a real sense of frustration. But my 10 years of doing this has given me real faith in voters, and that when given the opportunity, they step up to the plate. The energy that I get from folks in doing this work is pretty amazing. And even when there are concerns, those are often the people that I'm most excited to work with, because it makes us better.
And I think that there's like a balance to strike there, right? Because some of the concerns sometimes sound like voters are too stupid to be able to figure out what they really want. And certainly there's this voter education piece to explain, hey, here's how to, for your fullest potential, for your fullest democratic participation, here's how to do X, Y, and Z, versus assuming too little of people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I as a rule, never underestimate voters. I mean, I think, and at the same time, give people the resources to empower themselves, right? So what we've found over the years is when a voter sees a ballot, it tends to be intuitive. That's not necessarily all the time. We all have, you know, there's so many different learning styles, there's so many different things. So we want to be attentive to that in how we educate voters. But one thing that I think gets looked over sometimes when I hear that folks are concerned about voters not getting it, is this thought process is actually one we use all the time. The example I like to give is I have a nephew who's in high school, and in a couple of years, he's going to have to start making some choices about what comes after high school. And he's going to have to think of his options, his candidates, if you will. So it could be a 4-year program. It could be a 2-year program. It could be an apprenticeship. It could be taking a year off. Yeah, right. You know, there's all these options in front of him. And what he's going to need to do is decide, what's my optimal choice? What is the thing I really, really want to do? Now, what if maybe a test score doesn't get me there? What if something goes wrong and that can't be what I do? What's my backup choice, right? If I can't have that perfect. And like, that is a real life, tough, impactful decision. And realistically, that is ranked choice thinking in action. And so I think often what my job is to take it out of politics so that folks know that they think this way regularly enough to put it back in.
Well, we just had our primary election in Oregon, no ranked choice voting on that ballot, at least in Multnomah County. For voters next fall, are there different things they'll need to prepare in order to vote with full information?
I think so. It's knowing what's on your ballot, right? And that's any election, any time, regardless of the system being used, is hopefully knowing what races are on there and what you need to have an opinion on as a voter, right? So we know that there's a presidential election. We know that there are federal elections and all of those. And when we get to city elections, the main thing to know is it's going to look a little different on your ballot, right? Instead of just filling in that one bubble, you're going to be able to fill in that one bubble for your first choice, your one bubble for your second choice, and so on. So I've seen a lot of elections where voters have, you know, the old way of doing elections and ranked choice voting on the same ballot, and they do just fine. But I think for voters, it's really in those races, you have this opportunity to really weigh your options in a different way, right? So instead of adding in the layer of, okay, I have these choices, who do I really like? who has a chance of winning, you kind of get to eliminate that who has a chance of winning and really just focus on those choices in city elections. I can't guarantee that up and down the ballot, but that is up to the voters. And maybe they're, you know, maybe you're super excited, however it may be, but in those city elections, that layer is going to be removed and you get to really look at the field of candidates, decide who aligns with your values and your priorities and rank them in order.
Well, if our listeners are interested in learning more about ranked choice voting, maybe generally, but also, of course, in the Portland context, are there resources that you'd recommend?
So if voters are looking for more information, they can go to www.portland.gov/vote.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to hopefully connect with as many Portlanders about the election as possible in the coming months. So I'm glad to start here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. That was Grace Ramsey from Democracy Rising. She's a national expert in ranked choice voting, and we spoke about this new election method that Portlanders will be taking on in the fall. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Hey, everybody. It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO